Good morning and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. On Tuesday, Bridgewater Associates, the world's largest hedge fund, told its clients that if Donald Trump won, the Dow Jones Industrial Average would plunge 10% or just over 1,900 points. Oops! And they weren't alone. Citigroup predicted a 3-5% S&P 500 drop if Trump won. And the bank's strategist said that drop would happen immediately, like today. Goldman Sachs also predicted a big drop in the stock market and a plunge in the Mexican peso by about 25%. And there was a parade of other market experts and stock seers who predicted the same thing. Double oops. After an overnight freakout as the election results came in, markets staged a huge turnaround Wednesday morning when trading opened in New York. U.S. stocks were solidly higher in recent trading, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average up just over 150 points, or about 2,025 points higher than where Bridgewater said stocks would be on Wednesday. In fact, Goldman has a new note out to clients predicting what will happen to the stock market after a Trump victory, which they sent out to clients after Trump's actual victory. Their new conclusion? Not much. Goldman said the market is likely to end the year 2% lower than where it started today, just as it predicted before. Today's 150-point jump? Not something Goldman predicted. Triple oops. So why did market watchers get the Trump call so wrong? The often repeated word as to why stocks would plunge if Trump were elected president was uncertainty. And when it comes to markets, that's a scary word these days. In fact, ever since the financial crisis, when the thing few ever predicted would happen happened, the black swan, the possibility of uncertainties has become more cringeworthy than ever. But here's the thing that market watchers didn't factor in. While Trump brings new uncertainties, his win also answers one of the biggest uncertainties facing the market, i.e., who will be the next president. What's more, Trump's policies aren't as unpredictable as people were making out, and if taken seriously, they could actually be good for the stock market. Trump has said he wants to cut taxes for everyone, but particularly the wealthy and corporations. The last two cuts could be very good for the stock market. Lower taxes for wealthy people should mean more money flowing into the stock market. And lower taxes for corporations should mean higher corporate profits, which should boost the value of stocks. Another big fact that seemed to be missing from the market forecasters' crystal balls was the Federal Reserve. The U.S. Central Bank has been itching to raise interest rates, and markets were forecasting as of 5 p.m. last night that there was an 82% chance that they would at their December meeting. Generally, rising interest rates are bad for stocks. But now it looks like an interest rate hike is off the table, given that the Fed is likely to think that Trump's policies will add risk to the U.S. economy and global markets on their own. What's more, there's always a lot of uncertainty around interest rate hikes, and especially these days, given how long it's been since the last sustained Fed tightening cycle. So there's another big uncertainty that Trump removed, at least for now. The big wild card is what Trump's tariff policies mean for large Fortune 500 companies. Those huge multinational companies get a large and growing portion of their earnings overseas, so that could be a problem. If Trump declares a trade war with China, for instance, they could slap tariffs on our goods. But we import far more goods from China and others than we export to them, so the effect, even if we get into a trade war, could be muted. On top of that, Trump's proposed budget could add a projected $5.7 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. But with interest rates still near all-time lows and only moving up slightly on the Trump news, it seems the market still thinks there's appetite for all that debt, or that the U.S. economy will grow fast enough to justify it. But here's the big point. We weren't always as worried about uncertainties as we've been recently. There are always uncertainties. The future is unknowable. In fact, it's the role of markets to price risk. Collectively, investors can weigh the likely outcomes and come to the best prices. Our faith in the market was shaken during the financial crisis, but perhaps we're getting that back again. One more thought. Another thing we often hear is that markets like Washington gridlock. But after at least 8 years of it, perhaps the market has had its fill of the do-nothing Washington. Or maybe the market thinks, correctly or not, when Republicans are in power, a lack of gridlock could be a good thing. Either way, somehow 8 years after the financial crisis, with the economy on the best footing it has been in years, the uncertainty that is out there over a Trump presidency just doesn't seem so bad, at least for one day. This article, posted by Stephen Gandell, and originally appeared on Fortune.com. The good news for President-elect Donald Trump is that the U.S. military is, formally, an apolitical institution that takes its orders from the commander-in-chief, whoever he might be. Defense Secretary Ash Carter issued a memo to everyone in the U.S. military Wednesday morning saying the election happened freely and peacefully because of their work. "I am committed to overseeing the orderly transition to the next commander-in-chief," he said. "I know I can count on you to execute all your duties with the excellence our citizens know they can expect." The bad news for the newly elected president is that the military has informal ways of subverting those same orders, especially if it and Congress enter a tacit alliance to derail them. Trump has called for boosting defense spending by about $60 billion a year, a 10% hike, and an end to the lengthy, inconclusive wars that the U.S. has waged in Afghanistan and Iraq. He has said he wants to bomb the shit out of ISIS as part of his war plan because, quote, "I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me." That's not a good way to launch a productive working relationship with the generals and admirals and the nation's 1.4 million soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. Look for Trump in the coming days to scale back such rhetoric, just as he did in his acceptance speech early Wednesday when he spoke graciously of Hillary Clinton, who he had vilified for months. Such temperance will be required if U.S. national security policy is to remain coherent. Trump's very first steps as president-elect were about as good as could be hoped for, says Peter Feaver, an expert on civil-military relations at Duke University, who served on the White House's National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He and pointedly avoided mentioning the divisive issues that were prominent in the campaign. "The senior military will do what they're told, and many will welcome the change," says Merrill McPeak, a retired Air Force general. "Let's at least hope it will be good to have an out-of-the-box thinker not burdened by policies that have led to 15 years of unwon wars at a cost of nearly 7,000 lives and an estimated eventual cost of $6 trillion. David Barno, a retired Army three-star who led U.S. troops in Afghanistan in 2003 through 2005, says the president-elect also needs to jettison the inflammatory campaign rhetoric that sometimes cavalierly suggested a need to replace today's generals and admirals with ones of Trump's choosing. With no military experience, Trump's key tutor will be Marine General Joe Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Military officers, unlike nearly all civilian political appointees, don't lose their jobs when a new administration takes office. By law, the chairman is the key military advisor to the president, and Dunford wins high marks inside the Pentagon for his military smarts and political skills. "As of January 20th, we will have a commander-in-chief who is quite literally ignorant of basic U.S. national security policy," says Andrew Basevich, a retired Army colonel and military scholar. "It will be incumbent upon senior military leaders, above all the Joint Chiefs chairman, to contribute to his education, an urgent and sensitive task. It remains to be seen whether they will rise to the occasion." Given his dearth of experience, Trump also will have to select national security leaders that can reassure Americans at home and leaders abroad that there is a steady hand on the tiller. The personal qualities of those selected for political appointments in the defense establishment can be more important than pronouncements in party platforms or campaign rhetoric, says Charles Dunlap, a retired two-star Air Force general. I would also hope that retired flag officers return to the military's apolitical tradition, as opposed to the overt partisanship we saw from some during the campaign. That could rule out Mike Flynn, the outspoken retired Army Lieutenant General, who as recently as Saturday criticized Clinton for what he called her unbelievable active criminal behavior. His name has been floated as a possible defense secretary, director of national intelligence, or White House chief of staff in a Trump White House. While a president has more leeway overseas, including wars, than he does at home, Trump won't be able to achieve major national security changes unilaterally. Only the Senate can ratify treaties, and only Congress can increase defense spending. While Republicans will be the majority in both houses in the new Congress to be seated in January, it's likely to include as many deficit hawks as defense hawks. The military rank and file supported Trump, according to unscientific polls conducted during the campaign. Many come from rural parts of the country that helped Trump win, military officers said Wednesday. Some of Trump's claims, that he knows more about battling ISIS than the generals he soon will command, for example, was political theater that some didn't take seriously. Donald Trump has laid out a comprehensive, detailed, and forward-looking vision for the future of the American military, ex-Air Force Secretary Mike Wynn noted recently. It is predicated on peace through strength and a sober appraisal of U.S. national interests. Trump wants to boost the Army to about 540,000 soldiers, or 90,000 more than under current plans. He wants a 350-ship Navy and a 1,200-fighter Air Force, 10% increases over existing plans. The Marines would grow by 30% to 240,000 under Trump's proposal. But there seems to be a mismatch between how robustly Trump wants to bolster the Pentagon and what he wants it to do overseas. He has expressed a wariness to get involved in ill-defined conflicts. He also has shown a reluctance to let other nations, particularly those in the NATO alliance, count on continued U.S. military support if they don't spend more on their own militaries. He's basically calling for a wartime military with a peacetime mission. And while Trump's America First policy can make for a populist soundbite, it could lead to an isolationist nation where desiccated alliances, a major force multiplier for the U.S. championed spread of democracy and free trade since World War II, could increase Chinese and Russian influence around the world. This article posted by Mark Thompson. One of the few statements of regret I've seen from anyone in the TV industry came from Jeff Zucker, formerly President-elect Donald Trump's boss at NBC and now the head of CNN. Zucker stated that CNN probably should not have given unedited airtime to Trump's rallies. I'm not sure that's the problem I'd put first on my list of priorities. Broadcasts of rallies, though certainly disproportionate to the level of coverage Hillary Clinton received, had meaningful news value for Trump supporters and his detractors. Here, at least, was the candidate expressing his views. I'm more baffled by Trump's interactions with the entertainment side of the broadcast equation. On Saturday Night Live, on Fallon and Colbert, on Dr. Oz, the candidate went through an elaborate display of faux contentiousness with shows that, in each case, was more curious about how to keep this ride going than what Trump's rise would mean. SNL's cast members played off the host gamely enough, though Larry David, a guest, pretended to heckle him. Fallon challenged him, lightly, on Russia. Dr. Oz did not follow up meaningfully on any of Trump's claims about his health. In these broadcasts, he was able to fit his persona within a recognizable framework. He could look fairly close to the norm. If this is the institutional position of those shows, that's one thing. But in every case, the shows made a great and effortful deal of appearing to closely scrutinize the candidate, with Fallon going so far as to conduct a fake job interview to arbitrate whether Trump was worthy of office. He accepted every answer with a laugh. Trump's presidency, in particular, will serve as a daily reminder of one of the most vexed periods in NBC's history. After employing him for years as host of The Apprentice and airing his Miss USA pageant, the network fired him after he declared his run for president, citing inflammatory language about Latinos. But NBC then went on to feature him in its entertainment broadcasting, from a Saturday Night Live episode Trump hosted in November 2015, leading to a year of comic coverage that treated Trump and Hillary Clinton as equivalent figures, to a sunny to the point of pointless Jimmy Fallon interview in September. A successful politician appearing on entertainment shows is nothing new, but the message NBC sent in its programming was that Trump was unfit to be tied to NBC, except when he was popular enough to figure to boost ratings. Trump caught on tape having a vulgar and misogynistic discussion about women with NBC host Billy Bush was embarrassing enough to get Bush fired, but Fallon's hair-ruffling moment was standard operating procedure. It goes beyond NBC, of course. Stephen Colbert was solicitous of Trump in a September 2015 interview and apologized to him for jokes at his expense before he eventually took a tougher comic view of the politician, leading to a grave, sad elegy ending his election night special. Assigning much credit or blame to the media for the election of Trump seems specious in an era defined, we now know, by open revolt against that which is establishment. Had the media been tougher on Trump, would it have made a difference, given how many voters appear to get their news from Facebook algorithms? But it seems worthy to note that long before his election, Trump was effectively normalized by a TV industry that was fixated on a conception of the race as between two unsympathetic candidates who were equally unfit for office. Television news, again and again, showed us the ways in which Trump was an abnormal candidate. Televised entertainment, less frequently but even more assiduously, worked to put such concerns to rest. This article posted by Daniel Diodario. First Britain, then the U.S. These oldest of international friends have both been shocked by a tidal wave of anti-establishment fervor this year, which will completely transform each of their relationships with the rest of the world. The UK's referendum vote to leave the European Union in June means new Prime Minister Theresa May must construct fresh free trade agreements from Africa to Australia. This week, she led a trade mission to India, looking to boost her country's poor exports record, which is the lowest in the EU as a percentage of the economy, in readiness for when Britain goes it alone, expected to be in 2019. Donald Trump's presidential victory, meanwhile, may see the U.S. quit the North American Free Trade Agreement, unless Canada and Mexico renegotiate the terms of the deal to their own disadvantage. Trump's disdain for the EU will probably spell the end of 3 years of talks to establish the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Trump views his win as Brexit plus 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 and has spoken of his fondness for the UK, where his late mother Mary was born. Yet British fears over Trump's perceived volatility could mean the special relationship is at its weakest since the term was coined by Sir Winston Churchill 70 years ago. A recent survey of British members of Parliament, MPs, found that 80% of them thought a Trump presidency would make the world less safe, while a third of the governing Conservative Party felt he would damage the special relationship. Earlier this year, Trump clashed with Sadiq Khan, London's new Muslim mayor. In an interview with Time the weekend he took office, Khan warned that Trump's proposed Muslim ban would turn communities against each other. The Republican vowed he would make an exception for Khan so that he could visit the U.S., but this was not enough to placate the furious mayor. Now that Trump is poised to become president, few appear to be changing their minds. It's pretty terrifying, Bob Neal, the conservative chairman of Parliament's powerful Justice Committee, tells Time. Life is much scarier and uncertain now. Trump has a lack of commitment to NATO, having said he might not provide military support for its members, and that is something that underpins the special relationship. In an era when Britain wants to increase efforts to establish itself as a free trading nation, Trump's protectionist proposals are the opposite of what we would want. Angus McNeil, who chairs the House of Commons' new Committee on International Trade, says he will call Trump trade representatives to a hearing of his committee if he believes the UK is not getting fair terms in a deal with the US. The UK and the US have not taken rational choices recently. Democratic choices, but not rational ones, says McNeil. Donald Trump is used to getting his own way through bullying and cajoling. So if anyone thinks he will make a deal that does anything beyond what's good for Donald Trump, then they're in for a rude awakening. It's not impossible that I'll put out a call to Trump's representatives to see us, depending on how things pan out with the US. Trump did, though, promise to put a post-Brexit UK at the front of the queue for a US trade deal should he take the White House. This was a direct counter to President Barack Obama's warning that Brexit would see the UK at the back of the queue for trade. This has pleased some pro-Brexit lawmakers in the UK. The president-elect explicitly said we would be treated fantastically, says Dominic Raab, a former government minister. Mutual interest and ambition to make a trade deal will be strong. A lot of people are shocked, but when the dust settles, people will respect the U.S.'s decision, and the government will want to make the special relationship work more than ever. Another leading Brexiteer, who did not wish to be quoted on record about a sitting U.S. president, says Obama was rarely helpful to the U.K. during his years in office. The source points to Obama's fierce attacks on BP, the British oil giant, following the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico 6 years ago, as well as seemingly backing Argentina over the disputed Malvinas Islands. I liked Obama, but he didn't treat us particularly well. Louise Ellman, a senior MP in the UK's main opposition Labour Party, is no fan of Trump. He's absolutely unpredictable, she says, but believes Trump will be given a cautious welcome when he visits the UK. People will be curious about him more than anything else, she adds. Former Cabinet Minister Alastair Carmichael says Trump's channeling of the spirit of Brexit could mean that poorer Brits will warm to the Donald. Brexit and Trump are both the result of anti-politics, anti-establishment campaigns, says Carmichael. They're a reaction to parts of populations that have seen the downsides of globalization, such as pressure on incomes and employment terms and conditions. But Britain's middle classes, like many of those in the U.S., are shocked that Trump is now the leader of the free world. Sir Simon Burns, a conservative MP who regularly crossed the Atlantic to campaign for Hillary Clinton, is another who says he is terrified of Trump's new power. Yet even Burns accepts the U.K. will ultimately have to work with Trump if the countries are to maintain their closeness and establish their new economic paradigms. Regardless of who is president of the U.S., it's in Britain's national interest to have a special relationship, Burns says. God help us, we're going to have to deal with Trump, holding our noses to make it work. This article posted by Mark Leftley. When Hillary Clinton lost the Democratic nomination for president to Barack Obama in 2008, she delivered a now famous concession speech about what the moment represented for women in politics. Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it, Clinton said, and the light is shining through like never before, filling us all with the hope and the sure knowledge that the path will be a little easier next time. 8 years later, many women say they are heartbroken that the highest, hardest glass ceiling had yet to be shattered after Republican nominee Donald Trump defeated Clinton. But perhaps there's some light for those Clinton supporters. Women, particularly women of color, did contribute some cracks to that glass ceiling last night by winning historic races in their states. Meet the women who Clinton supporters are calling the tiniest speck of light of the 2016 election. Kamala Harris. California's senator-elect will become only the second black woman to serve as U.S. senator. The first was Carol Moseley Braun, who represented Illinois from 1993 to 1999, and the first Indian American elected to the Senate. Harris's victory also marked a significant milestone for California, which has never elected a black or Latino politician in its state Senate. Harris, who previously served as California's Attorney General, was born to Jamaican and Indian immigrants. She attended one of the first Berkeley elementary schools to integrate, attended the historically black Howard University, and built a career fighting for rights for women and minorities. Catherine Cortez Masto. Democrat Cortez Masto, a former Nevada State Attorney General, defeated Republican opponent Joe Heck to win a Senate seat in Nevada. She will become the first Latina senator in U.S. history and the first female senator from the state of Nevada. Cortez Masto, the granddaughter of a Mexican immigrant, has advocated for immigration reform and justice for human trafficking survivors during her political career. Tammy Duckworth. Representative Duckworth, a veteran who lost both of her legs while serving in Iraq, won back President Obama's former Illinois Senate seat for the Democrats by defeating Republican incumbent Mark Kirk. Duckworth, who currently represents Illinois in the House of Representatives, was born in Thailand and will help give the Senate the most Asian American women in its history. Duckworth will be the second female senator in Illinois' history. Ilhan Omar. Omar beat her Republican opponent to win a seat in Minnesota's state legislature, making her the first Somali American ever elected to a state legislature. The 34-year-old mother of three is also a Muslim and wears the hijab. Born in Somalia and lived in a Kenyan refugee camp for 4 years before immigrating to the United States, she has spent her career fighting against racism, religious intolerance, and economic inequality. "It is the land of liberty and justice for all, but we have to work for it," she says. "Our democracy is great, but it's fragile. It's come through a lot of progress, and we need to continue that progress to make it actually justice for all," Omar told the Huffington Post in October. There is a sense in this nation that something shifted in this election, and that what is coming to fruition is a fractured nation. We are told that there are two Democratic parties, the left-wing Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren supporters, and the moderate Hillary Clinton ones. We are also told that there are two Republican parties, the Donald Trump supporters and the traditional party stalwarts. The fault lines run in many different directions. America's soul is splintered. People have always harbored different opinions and experiences, but how did the Grand Canyon of distance between Americans come to be? The length of campaigns leads to an increase in the duration and depth of the division. 2 years of planning to defeat the other guy do not allow an easy or quick healing. There has been too much time for wounds to fester, for accusations to spread through the body politic, and for combatants to shore up their arguments. The mechanisms of unity are growing fewer. Everyone used to watch the same news, read the same newspapers, go to the same few movies, and watch the same few TV shows. With an increase in choice comes a decrease in shared culture. People for whom Hamilton was a major cultural event probably didn't know much about the NASCAR winner. The result is not division alone, but mutual incomprehension and stereotyping. The politicization of what used to be seen as neutral organizations or outlets means that there is no clear refuge from the division that stalks the rest of society. The police became a lightning rod for left and right, so did the FBI, and the media is divided. It seems there's no news station or newspaper that is not labeled by its adversaries as belonging to the left or to the right. Between the contending political factions, no man's land has disappeared. Often nations are brought together by a common enemy. But even here, while everyone agrees that we must address terrorism, cyber attacks, and economic issues, there is a split on who should be defined as the enemy and how to deal with it. Simply pleading for people to come together has no effect. The societal forces that promote separation are real and growing. The few places that remain apolitical, like professional sports, provide too few opportunities for lengthy, informal interactions that might reduce the cracks in the American soul. We need to encourage the spaces where we meet. Religious institutions should seek to stay apolitical so they can accommodate all people. Everything from playgrounds to bowling alleys should be areas of conversation and commonalities, not political argument. When public issues infect private relationships, friends become adversaries. The nation will not be healed from the White House. It has to be healed in backyards, in halls of worship, in public parks and clubhouses. Nothing lowers temperatures like seeing someone play with their dog or push a child on a swing. We need to leave the voting booth and be human again. In dictatorships, everything is about politics. Not here. America is not the land of politicians. It is the land of people. This article posted by Rabbi David Wolpe. David Wolpe is the Max Webb Senior Rabbi of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. Shock, sadness, anger, and fear spread across Mexico on Wednesday as the nation woke up to the reality of a U.S. president who has threatened to deport millions of its countrymen, rip up trade deals, and make it pay for a wall along the American border. The electoral victory of Donald J. Trump was already shaking the Mexican economy before dawn, with the peso weakening in aftermarket and Asian trading by 13%, its most rapid loss since the 1994 tequila crisis, which decimated the country. Mexico's stock exchange then opened to fall 4%. But market losses paled next to the long-term risk of facing a highly antagonistic U.S. government for the first time in generations. The United States became a superpower after the Second World War, and since then we have never had to face it being openly hostile towards us, says Alejandro Hope, a former member of Mexico's Federal Intelligence Agency. It is far more powerful than us, and it holds all the cards. If Trump takes a very aggressive stance to Mexico, it could do overwhelming damage. Trade between the two nations has mushroomed since the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, in 1994, and last year, Mexico exported $316 billion worth of goods and services to the U.S., accounting for almost a third of its $1.1 trillion economy. But Trump has promised to rewrite or scrap NAFTA to try to bring manufacturing jobs back north. There are also 11 million Mexicans living in the United States, about half without papers, and they sent back almost $25 billion in remittances last year. But Trump promised to step up deportations, at one point calling for a new deportation force. I feel uncertainty and indignation about where this will lead, said Sandra Ramirez, a social worker in Ciudad Juarez, which borders El Paso, Texas. The election of Trump reflects an intolerant society with a racism that has been woken up. Like many in Juarez, Ramirez crosses the border back and forth into El Paso on an almost daily basis. But she fears that Trump's presidency could lead to much harsher inspections on the border, as happened in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, when fear of terrorists crossing over from Mexico created backups that made many suspend going into the U.S. The Mexican government tried to give reassurances that it was ready for the Trump effect. Mexico is in a position of strength to confront the new environment, Finance Secretary Jose Antonio Meade said in a joint news conference with the head of the central bank. Meanwhile, President Enrique Peña Nieto tweeted that he was open to working with Trump. I trust that Mexico and the United States will go on strengthening their links of cooperation and mutual respect, he wrote. In August, Trump went to Peña Nieto's presidential palace in Mexico, a meeting that garnered widespread criticism here for pandering to a candidate seen as offending Mexicans. In a survey before the election, 83% of Mexicans said they had an unfavorable view of Trump. However, some Mexicans have more nuanced views to the Trump victory. Bernardo Estevez, who runs an orange juice stand near the Mexico City Center, says he respects Trump's nationalism. He wears the T-shirt of his nation, and he says that he is going to look after his people and screw everybody else, Estevez says. Here, our politicians just steal from us and take the money out of the country. Mexico has suffered a series of high-profile corruption cases, including that of the governor of Veracruz state, Javier Duarte, who went on the run last month following embezzlement allegations and is alleged to have more than 100 houses in the United States. Others believe that Trump's bark may be worse than his bite. Academic Jorge Chabot, who specializes on U.S.-Mexico relations, says that Trump will be constrained by both the courts and U.S. business. He will be the president of the United States, but not the owner of it, and not the king of a small country in Africa who can do whatever he likes, Chabot says. If he sticks a 35% duty on goods coming from Mexico, the first to complain will be the businesses in Texas and California who benefit from cheap Mexican imports. Another figure who weighed in on the Trump victory was presidential hopeful Andrés Manuel López Obrador, a leftist who hopes to replace Peña Nieto when his term runs out in 2018. López Obrador, who champions an anti-establishment nationalism that some have compared with Trump's discourse, released a video telling Mexicans not to worry. You must not forget that Mexico, because of the efforts and sacrifices of our founding fathers, is a country that is free, independent, sovereign, he said. It is not a colony. It is not a protectorate. It doesn't depend on any foreign government. This article posted by Ian Griot in Mexico City. Donald Trump, who dealt a stunning political blow to Hillary Clinton and the established order when he was elected the 45th president of the United States on Tuesday, now faces the challenge of governing a divided American electorate after a notoriously bitter campaign. On election night, Clinton supporters voiced fear and frustration, overwhelmed and bewildered by their candidate's unexpected loss. Some said they would avoid listening to the news the next day. Others predicted it would feel like waking up in an unfamiliar country. But on Wednesday, top Democratic and Republican leaders delivered a common message. They compared an unprecedented presidential election to those that came before and called on Americans across the political spectrum to unite in its wake. Now, as we do every 4 years, we have to work to heal the divisions of a long campaign, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan said. This needs to be a time of redemption, not a time of recrimination. We all need to rededicate ourselves to making America great and making it a more perfect union. Everybody is sad when their side loses an election, but the day after, we have to remember that we're actually all on one team, President Barack Obama said. This is an intramural scrimmage. We're not Democrats first. We're not Republicans first. We are Americans first. We're patriots first. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, a liberal leader who was one of Trump's most outspoken critics during the campaign, offered to put aside our differences and work with him to improve the economy. Trump, in his victory speech, praised Clinton for a hard-fought campaign and asked Americans to bind the wounds of division, wounds he had so often opened himself. Those wounds appeared most painful for Clinton supporters gathered at what was supposed to be her victory party in New York City. Before the results came in, they voiced concern about what a Trump victory would mean. I fear it'll just exacerbate and cause more separation between Americans and the world, said Wendy Siskin, 41. I don't think we'll be in a safe place. I don't think we'll be in a loving place. Saeed Zaidi, 51, said early in the night that he disagreed with Trump's approach to immigration and viewed his prospective presidency as very scary. Holding a sign that read, "Great leaders unite, they do not divide," atop Clinton's Stronger Together slogan, Zaidi said he hoped both parties would come together no matter who won the election. "It's too much hatred in the country," he said. "The whole world is looking at us as a democratic country in the world, you know? People come from all over the world for the freedom of democracy here." A New York Times CBS News poll published last week found that a majority of voters thought neither candidate was likely to unify the country after the race. Scattered protests throughout the country on Wednesday, including in Oakland, California, Portland, Oregon, and Austin, Texas, underscored the enduring divisions. In previous presidential elections, concession speeches have been key to minimizing hostility, said Scott Faris, author of Almost President: The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Most candidates in the past have understood that this is a precarious time during which what they say carries great weight and great meaning, Faris said. Every word needs to be pretty measured. In her concession speech on Wednesday, Hillary Clinton offered to work with Trump on behalf of our country. "We must accept this result and then look to the future," she said. "Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead." That message resonated with 33-year-old Clinton supporter Nicole Toon of Brooklyn, the New York City borough where Clinton headquartered her campaign. Toon had watched the election returns from Clinton's rally in Manhattan, seated on the perimeter of the outdoor block party with her 4-year-old daughter Dakota Rose asleep on her lap. "I wanted her to experience this," Toon said around 10 p.m. on Tuesday night. "We both agree that Hillary is the perfect choice." By the time Dakota Rose woke up the next morning, her mother's mood had changed. "Honestly, I'm distraught," she said. "It's like you lost a family member, like that kind of grieving feeling. I still can't believe it. I'm looking at the news like, is this what I'm seeing? President-elect Trump?" On Wednesday, she brought her daughter, who carried an American flag, a memento from Clinton's rally, to school. She cried while she watched Clinton's concession speech, and then she internalized her candidate's message. "Like Hillary Clinton said, we have to accept it and move on," Toon said. "We all could be devastated. I'm devastated, but we have to accept it and move on and show it's not all about one person." This article posted by Katie Riley. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.